Hello, and welcome to Stirring the Pot. I'm Linda Nygaard, and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes. I hope you'll pull up a chair, pour yourself a cuppa, and listen as my guests and I tell stories and share experiences of the many ways food affects our lives every day. Our culture, our history, our kitchens, ourselves, and our communities. If you can't listen to Stirring the Pot live, please know you can listen at your convenience at www.voiceofvashon.org. We'll always post a recipe, too. Today, my guest is Kate O'Kane. Kate is fairly new to the island. Some of you may have seen her in theater here and there. Kate was born and raised in the north of England, where she enjoyed proper fish and chips, which she can't seem to find in the United States. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Linda.
Welcome.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
I'm so glad you're here. Kate, a little bit of background for our audience. Kate's background has led her on business and on culinary adventures in some very interesting places around the world. Today, we're going to be going to China and Botswana. We'll be talking about some interesting things there. Kate and her husband moved to Vashon in December, and they're just really happy to be here. Can you tell me one of the reasons that you decided to stay here?
Well, some of it has to do with food. I mean, I love Asian food. So maize was a huge, huge influence on that. But really, we were sort of just getting excited about finding a new community. We actually Googled progressive liberal communities in Washington State.
Oh, you
and
did.
Funnily enough, Vashon came up. So
oh, wonderful.
We made it our home for the last 14 months or so and love being here.
Well, we're really happy that you're here.
Thank you.
And I'd like to start today by talking about what it was like in England and about your quote-unquote proper cup of tea.
Well, as you know, Linda, I'm probably the worst person in the world to talk about a proper cup of tea because I'm terrible at drinking them. You're supposed to have proper milk and sugar in it. And
right.
My mother also gets appalled. I think she's listening, actually, in the north of
hi,
England.
Mom.
So hi, Mum. But she gets appalled that if I have people around for afternoon tea, I'm serving it in mugs. You should be serving it in a teacup,
yes,
obviously.
You should.
But I didn't really ever drink tea as a child. But I remember going around to my grandmother's and it was always cup of tea, cuppa. I have a great friend, Angela, who cannot wake up in the morning unless someone brings her a cup of tea. It is that intrinsic to the way of living in the UK. I think very similar to how coffee is in Seattle, really.
Well, and if anything goes wrong or something's amiss, you need to have a cup of tea
proper
immediately.
Proper cup of tea, absolutely.
Yeah.
Lots of sugar in it to get over the shock or whatever
right.
it is that has happened.
Put your feet up.
Yeah. And honestly, I think especially in cold weather, sitting down with a cup of tea, whatever kind of tea it is, with milk or no milk, is always going to be the sort of medicine you need just to be feeling
part
a bit
of it's
better.
The ritual
it
of
is.
Enjoying pouring the hot water and smelling it
absolutely.
And hopefully sharing it with someone.
Yeah,
maybe
I'm
not.
Addicted to Lady Grey tea. That's my tea.
Are
if I
you?
Can't get hold of Lady Grey tea, then I think my husband starts sending out search parties because, you know, things may go awry.
I'm addicted to Billy tea from Australia.
I was going to say the Australian tea.
Oh,
yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, let's move on to England, eating, family dinners, Lancashire hot pot. What can you tell me about that?
Lancashire hot pot. So this is, I'm very fortunate. I come from a family who would sit down for tea, which is what we would call dinner together every evening. So we'd all get in, dad from work, mum from work, and the two kids from school, and we'd sit down at the table. And this was one of the things that mum could make because, you know, I grew up in a traditional home where mum
right.
did most of the cooking, although she has put that love into my brother and I. My dad is also trying. He makes a very good stew.
Oh, good.
And we'll leave
good.
It at that. But he's starting to do more cooking now. But mum would mainly do the cooking and she would create these things that she could come in and heat up or have ready.
Right.
And Lancashire hot pot is one of those things that you can be making sort of 3 or 4 hours earlier. It's an amazing dish of just heartiness and home.
Mm-hmm.
And you leave the meat and the potato in there to sort of like steam around a little bit and sort of like all the juices to flow in. So it's really Lancashire hot pot is, I guess, really a meat and potato stew. You can put some carrots into it. Mm-hmm. You can put some onions into it. But then you also in Lancashire, you put a pastry crust on the top and you just put that on at the end. And what was always great as a kid is we would also have extra pastry. And so you could maybe even make sort of like gingerbread men out of the pastry that you could dunk into the, your Lancashire hot pot later on.
Right.
So yeah, and then also you'd serve it with pickled red cabbage, pickled beetroot, and
oh, so you have a little onions. Tang.
There's
with
a little
the creamy,
bit of tang. Yeah,
that sounds really good.
And HP sauce.
HP.
Can't go
HP.
Out. Yeah, you've got to have your HP sauce
I know,
with
it's
it.
Good.
Yeah.
I have some in my fridge, by the way.
Oh. I might borrow it for when Dad comes around.
Okay.
Because I don't.
One of the things I learned about Lancashire hot pot after speaking with you about it was that it's thought to have been invented in the 1740s or 50s. And that's when the milling industry started taking over the north of England.
Yeah.
Lots of cotton imports from the slaves in plantations in America would be shipped over to England, mm-hmm. where they would mill it and make it into fabric, mm-hmm. sometimes into clothing, send that back to the plantations where they would use it and dress in it. And also, amazingly, a lot of it went to China.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting how so many of the sort of strands of my life kind of start merging together.
Right.
But certainly the town I come from, Wigan, it's a very small northern mm-hmm. town, and there's still many mills there. They're not working mills. They've been turned into sort of venues and, you know, kind of
hotels and,
kind
of
and places for people to live with the beautiful big windows. But really, it was very much a mill town. It was somewhere that you could make the food and then you'd go to the mill and then you would come back.
Well, that's why they think this was invented, because women started working. The business became so big and the industrialization of the area was so frantic that they needed everyone.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, child labor laws mm-hmm. weren't in effect then. And so really, the whole family went to the mill and worked.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so to have something out of the oven when they got home made life a lot easier then.
There's an amazing heritage museum actually in the town where I live. It was made famous by George Orwell's novel, The Road to Wigan Pier,
mm-hmm.
which he wrote having done a lot of travel
right.
around the north of England to understand truly what was going on in the 1930s when the mills were still very prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a heritage museum where you can go, and it has sort of an old kitchen and an old home and an
someday.
Old schoolway, schoolhouse as well. So.
Yeah. Well, another of, I know my favorites, and probably yours, is fish and chips. And I understand that we Americans have a little difficulty in preparing proper.
Well, look, I love my adopted homeland, and there are many things that I think are fabulous mm-hmm. here. And I don't want to upset anybody on the island by saying this, but I really haven't found good fish and mm-hmm. chips in this country. And it's not so much sometimes the fish or the chips, it's the combination of it all together. And my husband, bless him, you know, he knows that I am on this eternal quest to find good fish and chips. So we'll go off and find places, and the fish will be good because it'll be in the proper batter, but they'll serve it with fries and it's just not enough.
So tell me, okay, so let's talk about chips and fries.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me the difference.
So a chip is big, it's fat, it's juicy, right? It's kind of got maybe a good inch of width to it. It's not kind of like a little sticky fry.
It's more what we would probably call a wedge.
Yeah, but your wedges are kind of like a funny shape as well. Your chips are chipped potatoes.
Okay.
It's really hard to describe something.
Is there a potato chipper?
Yes, in a proper chippy,
yeah.
a fish and chip shop, a chippy that you go to, there's a proper potato chipper. But the main thing is the fat. So
mm-hmm.
it's been into the big flash fryer with all of the chips and then the fish is in the next bit and it's all drained together. So you get, I mean, it's so unhealthy. And that's why, you know, there's all these conversations about, especially in Scotland, where they start kind of like, you know, doing it with Snickers bars and Mars bars and all that kind of stuff. But it's so good. You know, lashings of malt vinegar all over the top, a bit of tomato ketchup. I'm not a fan of mushy peas, but mm-hmm. if you live in the north of England, I mean, I really shouldn't be allowed to be a northerner because I don't like mushy peas and I don't really drink my tea really strong with milk in it.
Boy,
but somehow
you're a renegade.
Somehow they let me in, but fish and chips.
So about these mushy peas.
Yeah.
Is it just mushy peas?
So they're especially processed peas.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a brand in the UK called Mushy, which is the pea brand. And hilariously, because I've lived in so many places, sometimes when my mum and dad come and visit, they have to bring things over. So my mum has traveled around the world with both Brussels sprouts for Christmas in China
mm-hmm.
and a packet of mushy peas for an Irish friend of mine who wanted mushy peas with his Christmas lunch.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. Well, we also spoke a little bit about the markets and going with your Nana to the market. And what was she looking for?
So Nana would go to the markets, the Wigan market, and she'd be looking for cow eel. So when you and I talked about this the other day, you had no idea what I was talking about.
I had no idea. I thought she's talking about an eel, and I must not know the name of this eel.
No, cow eel. So this is a cow's heel.
Heel.
And, you know, I really should have done more research on this, but I believe she would like stew it up and a little bit, I guess, like you would do with bone marrow or something like that. She would make something. And I remember once she would use it to make a sort of stew. And I'm going to get this story wrong. And when my mother comes over, she will tell it to you properly,
okay, Linda. Good.
But essentially, she made this thing and my mum tried to emulate it for my dad. Got it completely wrong, had to go and get some from my grandmother, dropped it on the way home in the gutter, scooped it all up, and my dad nearly broke his teeth on all of the grit that was in there because he basically was trying so hard. I think they were newly married. He was trying so hard to eat it all up. But cow eels, yeah. Not something you see often anymore.
No, it isn't.
And it's still on sale in Wigan Market.
I'm curious. Yeah. And another thing that you ate was... infamous squashed flies.
Or the Garibaldi biscuit.
Yes, the Garibaldi biscuit.
Which, again, is, you know, it's just, these are the things. This, again, is probably something from my nana, from my mum's mum, that she would have an aga and we'd go around for a cup of tea and to see nana, and she'd have a biscuit tin. And you weren't really allowed to look in the biscuit tin politely. You would just put your hand in and take whatever came out first. Of course, my brother and I never did that.
Well, you'd be like feeling around
like the most felt biscuits in Wigan in my nana's tin. But Garibaldi would often be in there, which was known as squash flies because it's just two biscuit layers with raisins in the middle, but they look like squashed flies because they've kind of like been smashed down inside. It's delicious. It's making it sound, I mean, there's so many things about British food.
No,
right?
I love squashed flies. Yeah, yeah. I know them and I love them. Well, you know, interestingly enough, Garibaldi biscuit, that's an Italian name.
It is.
And to me, it was really interesting that a biscuit in England would be named after an Italian.
Yeah.
So I did a little research and what I found was that it was named after an Italian military man who was fighting the in the rebellion, trying to keep the Austrians out of Italy. And Queen Victoria took a liking to him. Mm. And she invited him over and he came over and everyone loved him. It's been told that in the 1860s, 1864, I think, the whole town shut down because Garibaldi was coming. And it's also... fairly apparent that he didn't ever taste a Garibaldi biscuit because they weren't invented until 1861 by Peake and Friends. They just had a marketing idea, I think.
That's lovely.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting.
Do you know, now I just want a Garibaldi biscuit with my
tea.
Well,
I ordered some.
Excellent, thank you.
Yeah,
I was going to make you some Lancashire hot pot, but I haven't managed to get that done.
Well, I'm coming to your house for that.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, yeah. All right, so now, talking about community. How the English community bands together, even for the Italians, those poor people that were fighting. I'd like to talk a little bit about your experience in China, because I know that you lived in China where food and community are really part of every minute of their lives, literally.
Absolutely. I'm so fortunate. I've lived in so many places. And in talking to you about, you know, food recently, I don't think I'd actually put sort of an understanding in my head of how much food matters in China. And it took me back to how you would even greet people in China. You wouldn't say hello or how are you. You would actually say, have you eaten today? Ni chi fan le ma. And
is that the first thing you say?
That's the first thing you would say. I mean, I think it has changed. I lived in China for the first time in 1992. I lived in a very small Chinese town. It's now a big city of like 20 million. That's how much things have grown and changed there. But that was what you asked. You'd walk down the stairs, you'd go into your classroom. I was teaching, and that would be what you say, have you eaten? And it was very much a state of, are you happy? Do you feel complete? Are you feeling good today because you've eaten food? And it goes even beyond just that greeting as well. The way that you would greet people and make sure they felt like an honored guest would be to invite them for food or to take them out for a banquet or to invite them around to make dumplings or jiaozi.
Oh, I'd love
with
to
you,
do that.
Which
wouldn't
is
that be
amazing.
Fun?
Some of the most fantastic memories are going around and getting your hands into some proper sausage meat and some sort of like spring onions or green onions. You call them green onions here, right? The white ones. And sort of making the actual... the inside of the dumplings and then steaming them or frying them and then eating them. And you know, friendships are formed over dumplings, basically.
I'm sure they are. And you had a little story about dim sum.
Oh, I did. My mother's going to kill me because she's going to be coming over to the island in a few weeks and people will be going, is this your mom
is
with
the
dumplings?
Is this the dumpling thing?
So my parents love that I keep on living in different places because it means they get to travel.
Sure.
You know, we joke about the fact they don't really need to pay taxes in the UK anymore because they're out of the country so much. but they came over to China and we were taken out in one of those kind of like showing honor to your guests, taken out for dim sum by the dean of the university. And we're sitting around a big table, a circular table, as you do in China for dim sum. And I had not managed to tell my parents that in China, unlike in the UK, you finish your plate and that's how you show respect for the person who has cooked for you. Yeah. I enjoyed everything.
I ate everything.
It was great. In China, if you do that, your host thinks that you basically need more, that they have not filled you. And so my poor mother is sitting there eating this congee, which is a rice porridge,
right,
filled with what the Chinese would believe as delicacies. So that would be 100-year-old egg,
which is
the egg that has been basically kind of like stewed in urine of some kind. Innards of whatever animal the innards were from, and very many other things. And of course, I would have a little bowl, leave a little bit, and then hopefully never have any more. My mother, bless her, just kept on eating it. And just kept on eating it. And about four bowls in, when I actually thought she was going to explode, I'd managed to sort of say, stop eating. But bless her, she was being very polite, but I don't think she's ever eaten congee since.
I would bet that she didn't. And what about the markets that you went to?
I love markets anyway, whether they are markets outside or whether they are supermarkets. I mean, you know, I'm almost a daily shopper at Thriftway here because I just love going and seeing food and seeing what I can create. But in China, they are something else. They are almost like pet shops and and food stores and zoos all in the same place. There's an amazing one that still exists in Guangzhou down in the Guangdong province, which is the province right next to Hong Kong. And we would always take visitors there because it was so vibrant and so fascinating. You walk along a street, and I'm not suggesting that we should be eating cats and dogs, obviously. But at that stage, you know, people were still doing that in China. Mm. There was a very famous saying in China that we eat everything on the land except the car, everything in the air except the airplane, and everything in the sea except the boat. And they really do. And so we would go there and you would see snakes slithering in front of you, or there would be chickens. And I was telling you, Linda, about, you know, the other great thing that I used to love that was taking the market into the restaurant. And you would go and you would just kind of say, all right, well, I want to have chicken, so I'd like that chicken. And the restaurateur would kind of pick up the chicken. But
the chicken is still alive.
The chicken's still alive at this stage. You've chosen exactly which chicken it is. This could also be a fish as well. But the particular thing about chickens is they're not always easy to hold. So sometimes you would choose your chicken and the restaurateur would pick it up and he would just put it back on the ground. And then he would chase it into the kitchen. So you basically got a show and a meal at the same time.
What about the story when you were sleeping?
So my friend Maxine and I, who were traveling in China together, were up in Heilongjiang, which is the province right next to North Korea. And we were thinking about trying to get over into Russia, which we succeeded in, but that's a whole other story for a different radio show. And in the middle of the night, we were woken up and it was freezing outside. And I was sort of woken up by the hotel owner, told to move myself out of the bed. He moved the bed, he opened the floorboards underneath the bed, pulled out a frozen chicken, put my bed back, and then told me I could go back to sleep.
It must have been cold.
It was freezing, but we were wearing a lot of clothes, which we probably hadn't taken off in weeks. But it was, you know, and I don't even think I got chicken for breakfast, which was kind of like mostly the insult on the whole thing.
Oh,
he was
really
obviously getting
story.
It for some more honored guests that he has. So, yeah.
Well, I'd like to take a minute to thank one of our sponsors, Windermere. Voice of Vashon thanks Windermere Real Estate for its support, making our community information programming and our emergency alert service possible. Thank you, Windermere. We depend on you. You are listening to the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Linda Nygaard, and you're listening to Stirring the Pot. We're here with Kate McCain. Kate O'Kane. Sorry.
Right. I'm actually Kate McBride when I'm married and Kate O'Kane when I'm not married.
That's what happened. Well, so far we've been all over the world, it feels like. And there's one, you showed me a cookbook of yours called Cookbook, Mama Ma's.
Ma Ramotswe.
Yes.
So some people may know that name from the novels of Alexander McCall Smith. Precious Ramotswe is the lead character in his number one ladies detective agency series. And so after I left China, I was very fortunate to go and live in Botswana for a couple of years. And I have to be honest, Southern Africa...
So we should clue the audience in. We're in Botswana now.
We've left freezing chickens in China next to North Korea.
And now we're in hot
Yeah, Botswana. The Kalahari Desert. and the beauties of the Okavango Delta there. And so working there, you know, and food is not, I'd say, in Southern Africa, something that is really famed about the region. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things like pap, which is mealy meal and corn. So very sort of bland taste to my palate. They are eaten by the locals and loved, but to me, never really kind of like resonated. But Botswana is a fascinating place because you're sitting there in 32 degree heat. And then suddenly you're offered a fat cake, which is essentially a donut.
It looks like a donut. Yeah. But it's kind of flat.
Yeah.
It's a flat fat cake.
And evidently, I was doing some research on this, and it actually comes from the old Dutch for fat cakes, which
Afrikaans.
Is the donut. Yeah, the Afrikaans that that they were making. But the whole crazy irony for me with the fat cakes is that I was actually doing some work for an international NGO there, very focused on health, because obviously in Southern Africa, there has been a significant issue with HIV/AIDS for a long time. So I was there working on that. We'd go to the Ministry of Health. We'd sit. We'd talk about health. How could people live healthier lives, longer lives? And then halfway through the meeting, everything would stop. And people who'd been arguing for hours would suddenly be best of friends over a cup of tea and a fat cake.
And a fat cake.
And a little lady would come in with her trolley, sort of very 1950s England style, with her fat cakes and her tea, massive cauldron of tea, made properly, unlike me, and just eat fat cakes with your friends. And then you'd finish the fat cakes and you go back to arguing about how best to do it with the Minister of Health.
Food soothes.
It does.
No matter what, no matter where.
Always.
That's for sure. And I understand that there was kind of an international community down there. And
there was.
You had some interesting dinners.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a small country. It's about the size of France. And has only about 2 million people who live there. So you get to know a lot of people quickly. But there's not a lot to do, or there wasn't. I'm going back this summer, so hopefully we'll see if there is more to do. But there wasn't a lot to do for a single woman in her 30s. So I created a supper club. And I had a really good German friend, a great South African friend, a local Botswana friend, and then another British girl. And we would get together for supper, and we would do many people have done this, where somebody brings the main course, someone brings the starter, someone brings the dessert, and someone hosts. And then, of course, the person who was hosting was also supposed to provide some wine. But I'll be honest, everyone brought wine.
Everyone.
Because who can have a bottle of wine with just, come on.
And you need to make sure there's enough.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I know that.
So we would have supper club. And so, sometimes we would be quite adventurous, and other times it would be, had a long day, we're having pasta, and that's it. But it was more the joy of just sitting together, having supper together, chatting.
At a table.
And those girls are still some of my greatest friends, because we talked about everything over whatever we were eating.
And I understand, I don't know a lot about Botswana, but I understand that they raise a lot of beef.
They do. And they are actually, I think, one of the largest exporters of beef.
Really?
And so you'll drive around Botswana, and it's a beautiful country. And you'll just see massive stocks of beef everywhere. They're also one of the largest exporters of diamonds as well.
I knew
that. They found diamonds just after they gained, well, not independence, but they became independent of the UK. And so beef and diamonds, but the crazy thing is you don't actually get to eat a lot of beef burgers. So, you would think
there's no McDonald's,
there's no Burger King,
well,
there's
that's
a lot of
really
KFCs.
Nice.
Yeah, no. And that way it's fantastic. And you could get good beef to eat if you ate it at home, but it was just never, there was never this fast food culture of beef burgers, despite all this beef in the country. So it was kind of fascinating from that perspective.
I looked at this cookbook for you and the listening audience. Kate brought a cookbook in, I told you earlier, and it is the most colorful, beautiful, well-written book.
Yeah,
I just loved it. And I found something that I really liked in it on page 7. And he's talking about Ramotswe. And the quote is, "She loved standing in the kitchen, stirring the pot, thinking over the events of the day, sipping at a large mug of bush tea, which she balanced on the edge of the stove." It's so colorful and descriptive. And then there are many, many recipes for beautiful. I mean, here's a Reed's marula steak and stews and beautiful foods that you wouldn't think of, along with the gorgeous photos of the beautiful people.
It's a stunning book, and actually some friends helped put it together. It's very focused on really Botswana culture, and where food and where tea plays a role in that. And you can see that, especially from the books of Alexander McCall Smith as well. I mean, Precious sits down with a cup of tea. She gets a new case into the detective agency. Cup of tea first.
Get cup of red leaf.
Couple, yeah, the rooibos. Rooibos tea. Yeah, which is also
I see the recipe for Rose's fat cakes, and it's cake flour, salt, yeast, sugar, and water.
Yeah.
And then fry it.
And fry it up, especially outside in the 32 degree or 85 degree heat.
And you can... it can be savory or sweet, correct?
You can add sugar to it, but actually they that very rarely happened. They just ate it as as it was, as the fat cake itself. Yeah.
Well, so that brings us back to Vashon. And, you know, you said that one of the reasons you came here was the food. And how have you found it? And what do you like? And tell us about Vashon and your experiences here.
Well, as you can see, but the audience cannot, we're not starving. we are finding plenty to eat. I think that was one of the other reasons, really. It was kind of having enough things to do, enough places to go. And that's the joy of this island, right? There's always somewhere to try. There's so many different things going on. I just saw that Megan at Snapdragon had just put on an Indian taco that she's doing today. Snapdragon.
I saw that.
Which I'm desperate to try because I also miss good Indian food as well.
Well, she's talking about American Indian.
Is she?
Yeah, American Indian fry bread.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that makes it even more exciting.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's things there that I feel as though there's new things coming all the time. I tried the Little Fish pop-up the other day as well, which was a delightful.
Delicious.
Had a really nice brunch there and it was actually funny because it reminded me a little bit of China and how, you know, you would point at things to say that you wanted to order that or you wanted to order that. And so lots of people coming in, looking at the menu, but then looking at what my friend Linan and I were having for brunch and sort of asking us about it. And so again, the community was being built around food
around
at these
the
tables.
Food,
and like, what's that? Oh, it's this. So do you want to try it? Yes, have it. And so just getting to know people just from even just eating at tables very close to them as well. But even beyond that, it's sort of being able to bring parts of my life and my culture to people here and then getting to know more about theirs as well. So, you know, that may be going and sitting and having some food with somebody. It may be inviting them around for a cup of tea and a biscuit. And because I think we are a much more rural community, there is a lot more of going around to people's houses or trying to meet up because otherwise you'd be very isolated.
There is, and there's that friendliness that happens when people smile at you on the street and you don't even know them.
Yeah.
You know, that means a lot to me too, in Vashon, the sense of community that we have here.
Absolutely.
Well, I'd like to spend a couple of minutes, if we can, talking back in the beginning. Let's talk about the hot pot because we're going to have a recipe on the web, on our website for that. And I just wondered if you had, are there any little tricks or is there something we need to know? Maybe you should describe the layering of it.
Yeah, I mean, so Mom and I were sort of texting and calling back yesterday just so I could make sure I could get this right. I think the main thing about it is not kind of like trying to make it too fancy. This is really a hearty homemade meal. And so, you know, in the recipe, you'll see about chopping the scrag end neck of lamb or the beef
shin. I love
in
the term scrag end.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was reading about it and I read that in the beginning, back in the days of the 1500s or whenever it was, that would have been the 1700s. They used the whole leg bone and the bone protruded from the crust.
Yeah.
And I just can't. That doesn't sound very appetizing.
Well, it's funny because I was looking at some pictures of it, trying to find a proper picture.
Right.
And they even have people like Gordon Ramsay trying it with the lamb, sort of like bones coming out. So it is still happening. But just don't take it too seriously. Just kind of like throw it all in. Make sure it stays moist the whole time. But do make the crust. The crust is really the bit that kind of like adds in and makes it.
And so the crust
proper.
Is a typical
short crust pastry.
Like a pie crust.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, your water, your flour, a little bit of salt, and then your lard or butter.
Well, I can't wait to try it, and I will try it.
Well, if Mum's listening.
Maybe I'll invite you over.
Well, if Mum's listening, we'll get her to make
it
properly.
Okay, that'd be great. Kate, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And we just ran out of time.
I know. Linda, it's been lovely. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'll see you around the village, I'm sure.
I
hope you all will tune in again next week to Stirring the Pot on Wednesday at 1 o'clock.